To say it kindly, in a disagreement, friends can misrepresent the truth. If I were going to be blunt about it, I would say they lie. Have you ever got into a disagreement and somebody so exaggerated their position and what they thought about you that you end up saying, that's just not even true. Where did you get that? It happens very frequently, I submit to you, in all kinds of disagreements and disputes. I think it happens among married people as much as anybody. It also happens in other situations. Well, that's what happened to Job. The situation got so bad that I think you could only describe what happens next as his own friends lying to his face about what they thought was going on. What I want us to do is look at those lies and look at the presentation of them, and then Job's response. And in the midst of all of this, some things that we should take away. One commentator said, this is the third speech of Eliphaz. It was even more discourteous than he had ever been previously. And that's putting it mildly. So will you turn with me to Job chapter 22. Job chapter 22. Now while you're finding that passage, let me remind you that Job has three friends, and they each speak in round one, they each speak in round two, and only two of them speak in round three. We've looked so far at round one and round two, and what we're going to start this time is round three. The first speaker in each round is Eliphaz, and that's the case here. So verse one says, he said to Job, can a man be profitable to God, though he is wise, may be profitable to himself? Now what's going to go on in these opening verses is Eliphaz is going to give a rebuttal to all that Job has said so far in answer to these other friends, including Eliphaz, in both of the rounds. So what he's saying here is this. He's asking Job if he thinks that a man can be profitable to God. Now, Job has claimed that he is righteous. And what Eliphaz is saying in this verse is, well, so what? Is that of any benefit to God? Now, it might be a benefit to you, but it's of no benefit to God. That's the point of verse 1. He says in verses 1 and 2, and says in verse 3, is any pleasure to the Almighty that you are righteous? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways blameless? God doesn't need your righteousness or your blamelessness. What does he get out of that? So you're screaming your head off about you being righteous. So what as far as God is concerned? He says in verse 4, it is because of your fear of him that he corrects you and enters into judgment with you. Now, at this point, Eliphaz is going to use the language of the courtroom. Notice the word judgment. And this is he's going to use the language of being in court. And he is saying, God corrects you because you fear him, not because you're righteous. Then he says in verse 5, is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end? Can you imagine saying that to somebody? I mean, you're Job, if you just look at it, I mean, you are really not just a sinner. You're a big sinner. And if we started counting all the sins you committed, why, it's without end. You are just one more wicked, greatly wicked person with endless iniquities. And now his point is, God is not going into litigation with a man as wicked as you are. Because Job's been saying, if I just had a chance, I'd present my case before God. Again, using the court analogy. And Eliphaz is saying, forget it. God isn't going to deal with somebody as bad as you are. So his rebuttal is that neither Job's claim to righteousness nor his fear of God means anything to God. The only issue is You are a great sinner. Now I say, that's a little blunt. Well, it gets worse. Beginning in verse 6, he goes on what I'm going to call a rant. And what he does is he rants and raves about Job's sin. Only now what he does, and this has not been done before in the book of Job, he's going to get specific. He's going to name specific sins that Job's guilty of. Now, what is this? Chapter 22? Well, the first couple of chapters are an introduction, but we've been going on for 20 chapters accusing Job of being a sinner and him trying to answer it, but nobody's said what the sin is. Not like this does. So look at verse 6. For you have taken pledges from your brother for no reason and stripped the naked of their clothing. Now, the word pledge here is a security that you would put up for a debt. And clothes in that day were very, very valuable. So the backdrop of what's going on here is that somebody has put up a pledge of expensive clothing against the debt, and Eliphaz is accusing Job of taking these valuable possessions like clothing without a legitimate reason for doing so. Now, let's pause for a minute. There is absolutely no evidence of this anywhere in the book of Job. As a matter of fact, what we know from Job that's stated in the introduction is that the exact opposite is true. In other words, this is just a bald-faced lie. He just pulled this out of the air. There's no truth to this whatsoever. There's no indication anywhere in Job that was even close to true. But he keeps going. Verse 7, you have not given the weary water to drink, and you've withheld bread from the hungry. Now, this is a reference to hospitality. And in the ancient world, to withhold hospitality was a grievous offense. And so that's your sin, Job. You don't care about people. You wouldn't even give a stranger a drink of water. Pretty heavy. All right, he continues. He says in verse 8, but the mighty man possesses the land and the honorable men who dwell in it. As you know, Job was a wealthy, powerful man. And what he's being accused of here is taking land of the poor by force and using it for himself. Again, there is no evidence of this whatsoever. Everything we know about him says this is the exact opposite of what's going on. In other words, he's lying. Look at verse 9. You've sent widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. He is accusing Job of sending poor, helpless widows away without helping them, and then crushing defenseless, fatherless children. Now, from a biblical point of view, to do such a thing was of special magnitude of a crime. So, in verses 6 through 9, he lists his sins. Number 1, robbing the poor. Number 2, holding water from the weary. Number 3, taking land by force. Number 4, abusing widows and orphans. So he concludes in verse 10 and 11, therefore snares are all around you, and sudden fears trouble you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and the abundance of waters cover you. As a result of your sin, calamity is all around you. That's your problem, Job. You're having all of these difficulties because you are such a great sinner. And to prove his case, he even manufactures some sins. He's lying. Now, he then rants more. And now he is saying, and furthermore, you are spiritually ignorant. Job, you're just stupid. Look at verse 12. Is not God in the height of heaven and sees the highest stars, how lofty they are? In other words, God is exalted over everything. And you say, what does God know? Can he judge through the deep darkness? Thick clouds cover him so that no one can see him, and he walks about above the circles of the heavens. God is exalted above everything, and you ask, what does he know? In other words, you're spiritually ignorant. If you think God does not see the wickedness that's going on in the world, that he's covered with some thick cloud, and he doesn't see your wickedness, you are simply ignorant. Verse 15, would you keep to the old ways which wicked men have tried, who were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away like a flood? Are you going to stick to the view that wicked men of old had, that wicked men whose lives were cut off by a flood? This is probably a reference to the flood that we know about. They did not think God was watching and judging them. Are you going to hold that view? So he says in verse 17, they say to God, depart from us, for what can the Almighty do to them? The wicked men of old told God to get out of their lives. Is that what you're going to do? Yet he lifted their houses with, filled their houses with good things, but the counsel of the wicked is far from me. Job had said, the wicked prosper. He said that in the previous chapter, by the way. And the counsel of the wicked is far from him. So Eliphaz sarcastically says to Job, what does God do to the wicked? Well, according to you, he fills their house with good things. That's biting sarcasm. The righteous see it and are glad, and the innocent laugh at them. Surely our adversaries are cut down, and fire consumes their raiment. The righteous see the destruction of the wicked, and they're glad. They laugh. The righteous are glad when a murderer is seized and punished. So he's now becoming, in my opinion, unbelievably vicious. So he goes into this rant over Job's specific sins and his spiritual ignorance. And he does one more thing. He has the nerve to make a recommendation. So here's the recommendation. Chapter 22, verse 21. Now acquit yourself from him and be at peace, thereby goodwill will come to you. Translated, get right with God and you'll be better off. Receive, please, instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. Look, you idiot, listen to the Lord. If you think I'm being a little crude and blunt by saying, look, you idiot, that's about what's going on here. That's about the kind of way he's talking to him. So my recommendation is you listen to the Lord. Get right with God. He says in verse 23, if you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tent. If you return to the Lord, he's going to bless you. Then you will lay your gold in the dust and the gold among the stones of the brook. Lay your gold in the dust and among the stones. In other words, don't trust your money. Don't trust your gold. This is the point. So, if you do what I'm telling you, if you buy my recommendation and get right with God, then here's the results. Verse 25. Yes, the Almighty will be your gold and your precious silver. If you follow my recommendation and get right with God, God will be your gold and silver. Then he says in verse 26, for then you will have your delight in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. You will make your prayers to him. He will hear you and you will pay your vows. If you get right with God, God might even answer your prayer. You will also declare a thing and it will be established for you. So light will shine on your ways. In other words, your plans will come to fruition and not frustration. And when they cast you down and you say exaltation will come, then he will save the humble person. When others are afflicted, you will be able to help them. He will even deliver one that is not innocent. Yea, he will be delivered by the purity of your hands. The man who returns to the Lord will be able to deliver the guilty by his pure hands. All right, let me see if I can summarize this. If you meet these conditions, Job, God will give you prosperity, restoration to fellowship, trust in God, delight in the Almighty, fellowship with God, answered prayer, a desire to fulfill your vows, success. You'll help other people who are low and discouraged, and you'll have deliverance from those because of your, through your intercessory prayers and clean life. So, to sum up this speech, he is saying, you're a sinner, and you need to return to the Lord, and if you do, you will be abundantly blessed. And that basically is the whole idea. The problem is that in presenting his case, he has lied. He has simply conjured up sins that didn't exist and said that Job was guilty of them. So, before we look at Job's answer, or at least his response, let me make a couple of suggestions. I've used these interactions in the book of Job to suggest this is the way not to be a friend. So I'm going to continue that for this and one more session. And so in this session, let me say that the lesson is real simple. Don't lie. Just don't lie. What Eliphaz accused Job of doing was simply not true. He fabricated all of these sins. Someone has said, if in the past Eliphaz had been at all guarded in his criticism of Job, he is guarded no longer. Prior to this, the only straightforward indication of Job's friends had dared to bring against him was concerning his attitude. Apparently, the righteous man's conduct in the past had been so unimpeachable that there was nothing obvious to pin on him. And so we can only assume that these new charges constituted pure slander. End of quote. And I think that hits the target right in the middle. So just don't lie. You say, well, I wouldn't do that. Oh, yeah? Did you ever get in an argument? For example, married couple starts arguing and they say things like, you are always late. Now, is that true? All right, 90% of the time. Is that true? In the heat of the argument, have you ever done that? Come on, be honest. Who of us hasn't? And that's what I mean about don't lie. Don't lie. Don't exaggerate. You don't have to do that to win your case. We do it when we generalize when we shouldn't. So let me make a second suggestion, and it's the corollary to that, namely that we should seek the truth. Now, I'm wording this very carefully. I don't think his friends were interested in finding out the truth. I think they had a point of view, and they were interested in beating Job up with their point of view. They wove it into a whip and beat him to death with it. They were not interested in the truth. I think we've all had conversations like that when the other person, what they were saying was right, and we didn't want to admit it. You ever done that? I remember one outstanding case when I did it. I got into a debate with a pastor. I was speaking for him for the week, and he and I got off on some theological point, and I took one position, he took another. And this was of no major consequence. We just spent the whole week debating it, that's all. And after I had, given my case, there's no way I was going to give in, right? I mean, I have to defend my position, right? So I didn't hear a thing he said until I got out of town and I thought about it. I thought, you know what? He really does have a point. You ever done that? Now that's what I mean when I say seek the truth. I didn't say speak the truth. I'm assuming that. I'm saying seek it. That's got to be your basic attitude. I really want to know the truth. Within the last week, I had a conversation with a fellow, and I was witnessing to him. And at the end of the conversation, I said to him, it seems to me that what you're really not interested in doing something like seeking the truth. You would like to be religious, maybe, to have some social needs met. And he was clearly saying that. And I said, I think the issue is you got to ask the question, what's the truth? Not what's the best religious route for me to take to have some of my personal and social needs met, but what's the truth? It seems so simple to me at that point. And yet I think that often escapes us. In the heat of the argument, we want to defend our position instead of really asking, what is the truth here? So my advice is, if you want to be a good friend, don't lie, don't exaggerate, don't generalize, but seek to know what's the truth. Listen to determine the truth. All right. At this point, Job responds. Technically, he does not answer all these allegations until chapter 31. So he doesn't bother to answer tit for tat like he has on another occasion. I brought that out once as we were looking at his responses. In this case, he does something else. The first thing he does is he expresses his desire. Let me just tell you what I really want. I find this most fascinating. Look at chapter 23, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter, my hand is listless because of my groanings. Prior to this, on three other occasions, he's spoken about his bitter experience. His point here is that even until this day, he is still having a bitter experience. So, he says in verse 3, oh, that I knew where I might find him. And if you're looking at your Bible, notice that's capital H. Where I might find the Lord, that I might come to his seat. So here is the desire that I spoke of a moment ago. His desire is that he might bring his case before God. His prayer, his first prayer, is, oh, that I might his prayer is not that I might be healed of the disease, but rather that I might have a hearing before God. His prayer is not that my kids would be resurrected and I could see them again, or that my property would be restored. His first and foremost cry is that I may just find him, that I may come and sit before him. I just want to present my case to him. Verse 4, I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. If I had the opportunity, that's what I would do, and that's what I desire. So he says in verse 5, I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. In other words, I'd like to know what God thinks of all of this. I'd like to know what his decision is. Would he contend with me in his great power? No. He would take note of me, verse 6. If I had the opportunity to present my case before the Lord, he would not overwhelm me with his power. He would simply listen to me. So he says in verse 7, there, the upright would reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. Notice the capital J. The Lord will not only listen, if I could just get the opportunity, this is what I want. I want to present my case to the Lord. And let me tell you, if I ever had that opportunity, he'd vindicate me. I'm telling you, I'm innocent. I'm not the sinner you think I am. And if I could just have my day in court, I'm confident that's what would happen. So his desire is to present his case before God, and he's confident that if he does, he'll be found innocent. He'll be vindicated. So having expressed his desire, now that's what I really want, which is another way of saying, by the way, I'm seeking the truth. I just want to know the truth. I want God to show me the truth. I'd listen if he'd tell me. I'm convinced I'm right. I want to hear God say it. Then he goes on and just makes some, for lack of a better word, some declarations. He says in verse 8, look, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, and I cannot perceive him. When his works are on the left hand, I cannot behold him. When they turn to the right hand, I cannot see him. He's lamenting, I can't find the Lord. Verse 10, but he knows the way that I take. When he tests me, I shall come forth as gold. All right, and we've been running pretty fast through these verses. We have to stop and pause at this one. This verse is usually taken to mean that when I'm tested, I will be pure gold. As a matter of fact, in studying the book of Job, I came across, I don't know how many, I lost count, how many people tried to make this verse say, when I'm tried, I'll come out as pure gold. In the context of the book of Job and this passage, that is not what he is saying. In the context, he is saying, I am confident that if I get my case before God, I'm going to be found not guilty. So he's not talking about trials in the way we normally think of it, though that's the way the verse normally gets interpreted. All right, verse 11. My feet has held fast to his steps. I have kept his ways and not turned aside. In other words, he's claiming, look, I've been obedient. I've kept God's law. I've kept his word. Matter of fact, he says in verse 12, I've not departed from the commandments of his lips. I've treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. What a claim. Matter of fact, we ought to pause there for about 6 months. Could you actually say that you treasured the word of God more than your food? So he's insisting he's not deviated from God's word. Indeed, he has treasured it more than his own food. Do you know how much I like food? You want to say that you treasure the word more than your food? That's quite a claim. But I think, Job, that was probably true. What he's arguing is, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm innocent of all these charges you're making. That's the point. So he says in verse 13, but he is unique. Notice the capital H. He's talking about God. And who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. So God is unchangeable. Nobody can change him. He's sovereign. For he performs what is appointed to me, and many such things are with him. This unchangeable God is doing what is appointed for him. So you can't change him. So I accept that. But I tell you what, therefore, verse 15, I am terrified at his presence when I consider this. I'm afraid of him, that when he considers God's sovereignty, he stands in awe. He's terrified. For God makes my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face. The Lord has so terrified him by what's going on that he's weak. That is, he feels faint because he has experienced calamities here called darkness. So, in his response, the first thing he says is, I desire to present my case before God. And the second thing he does is he declares he cannot see God, that he's innocent, but that God is sovereign, and that scares him to death. The next thing he does is he expresses his disturbance. He asks a question. Chapter 24, verse 1. Since time was not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know him not see his days? In other words, Job is perplexed. Since nothing is hidden from God, he cannot understand why he doesn't give us the solution to the problem of the wicked's prosperity. Remember, the friends are arguing that the wicked don't prosper. You haven't prospered, therefore you're wicked. And Job has come back and argued, no. Open your eyes and look around. Obviously, wicked people prosper. So now he is saying, why do those who know him not see his days? Why don't we? He's perplexed. It's hidden from us. Now, what he does at beginning at this point is he mentions specific sins that go unpunished. Now, this is important because his argument is, and this is really the rebuttal to his friends, is, but the wicked do prosper. And now he's arguing, and the wicked sins don't get punished immediately. And he gives specifics. Matter of fact, he gives a number of them. The first one is, they steal. Some remove landmarks, verse 2. They seize flocks violently and feed on them. Now, landmarks were stones put along property lines. They marked the land. And what would happen is a neighbor would come along and move the landmark. They didn't have surveys in those days, surveyors. And they would move the landmark and they would get more land. It was a way of stealing land. And so Job says, you know, people are land grabbers and they don't get caught. Matter of fact, he says, they seize flocks violently. Some are sheep stealers and they don't get caught. Is it true that all crime gets punished? Of course not. I don't know how many times in my life, at least two or three, I've had my car broken into and people stole things and you never saw that stuff again. Matter of fact, I once had somebody break in my house and steal stuff. And that's Job's point. They steal and they get away with it. Look at verse 3. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. The wicked steal from orphans and widows and they get away with it. The second thing he says is they mistreat the poor. Verse 4. They push the needy off the road. All the poor of the land are forced to hide. Wow. They push the poor off the road so that they cannot beg. And they don't get caught. So that's what he's saying. They steal and they mistreat the poor. Now he goes on and on about this. Look at verse 5. Indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to their work, searching for food. The wilderness yields food for them and their children. The victimized wanders about like a wild donkey in the desert, searching for food for themselves and their children. They gather the fodder of the land and the glean of the vineyard of the wicked. The victimized gather grain, probably barley, in the field, and grapes in the vineyard of the wicked. They spend the night naked without clothing and have no covering in the cold. The victimized spend the night in the cold without a blanket. They are wet with the showers of the mountains and huddle around the rock for want of shelter. Now he's talking about the poor people that are being victimized. They have no shelter. They get wet when it rains. Some snatch the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge from the poor. The wicked steal breastfeeding children from helpless widows to sell them for slaves and make them slaves from themselves. Boy, is that cruel. There's nothing new under the sun. Does stuff like that go on today? Yeah. Watch the evening news. Nothing new under the sun. Verse 10, they cause the poor to go naked without clothing, and they take away the sheaves of the hungry. The wicked so mistreat the poor that they go naked. And when the poor work in the fields of the wicked, they're not allowed to satisfy the hunger with a small portion of the crop. By the way, later in the Mosaic Law, and Moses comes way after Job, this was forbidden. If you worked in the field, you were allowed to eat some of the grain in the field. But Job is saying, wicked people don't allow the laborers to do that, and they get away with it. There was no government to come in and stop them or take them to court. He says in verse 11, they press out oil within their walls and treat wine presses, yet suffer thirst. The wicked are so mistreated, so mistreat the poor, that when the poor work in the wine press, they're not allowed to quench their thirst with the wine that they're producing. Mistreating of workers and employees. The dying groan in the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong. So he's been talking about working in the countryside. Now he's going to move to the city. And he says it happens in the city just like it happens in the country. That there's all kinds of mistreatment of the wicked, and God does not punish them. His third illustration is they work at night, the wicked. So he says in chapter 24, verse 13, there are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its way nor abide in its path. They rebel against the light. They do not know it and they don't obey it. The murderer rises with the light. He kills the poor and needy, and in the night he is like a thief. He says, let me give you an example. The murderer rises at the light. That's daybreak. It's not quite day yet. To kill people. To kill poor people and needy people. And under the cover of darkness, in the middle of the night, he robs them and doesn't get caught. Oh, this one's interesting. Verse 15, the eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he disguises his face. The adulterer waits until nightfall, wears a mask, thinking that no one will see him when he goes to commit adultery. And again is, and God doesn't stop it, and God doesn't punish him immediately. He gets away with it. That's his point. So he says, verse 16, in the dark they break into houses, which they mark for themselves in the daytime, and they do not know the light. This is a really interesting verse. They mark the house in the daytime. In other words, they case the joint in the daytime. But they break into the house at night. That is exactly what he's saying. Nothing new under the sun. For the morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. If someone recognizes them, they're in the terror of the shadow of death. The morning light is the same to burglars as the shadow of death. That is, they favor night for their activities, because the morning is to them the shadow of death. If they do it in the middle of the day, they'll get caught. They'll be killed. So, in these 17 verses, Job is disturbed over the fact that the wicked steal, mistreat people day and night without being punished. And that is his point. The wicked get away with it. So, he does one more thing. In the rest of the verses in this chapter, and in this speech of his, he says things like this. And by the way, we're going to pick up at verse 18 and go down through verse 24. These are exceedingly difficult verses to interpret. Some have said they're some of the most difficult because we don't know exactly what he's referring to sometimes. For example, look at verse 18. They should, notice the word should is in italics. What does that mean? It's not in the original Hebrew text. They should be swift on the face of the water. Their portion should be cursed in the earth so that no one would turn into the way of the vineyard. If the words should and would are supplied, as they are in this translation, the meaning is the wicked should die quickly and their land should be cursed so that no one would go into their vineyard. But his point is that doesn't happen. Verse 19, as drought and heat consume the snow waters, so the grave consumes those who have sinned. As waters from the melting snow fall into the valley and are slowly melted and consumed by the heat, so those who have sinned will be consumed slowly. They die slowly. And they die without shame. Verse 20, the wound should forgive him. The worm should feed sweetly on him. He should be remembered no more, and the wicked should be broken like a tree. It says, when they die, even their mothers, described here as the womb, forgets them. The worm eats their body, and they're broken like a tree. For he preys on the barren who does not bear and does no good for the widow. The wicked prey on the barren, that is, the women who have no children, and they do not help widows. Yet, he promises to live in prosperity and to die without any visible token of divine displeasure. They get away with it. Don't you see? That's what he's arguing throughout all of these verses. Verse 22. But God draws the mighty away with his power. He raises up, but no man is sure of life. Notice again, the word God is in italics. Thus, Job is probably describing a mighty man, not God, who raises up, that is, he enters into the enterprise to do evil, but no man is sure of life. So he says in verse 23, he gives them security, and they rely on it, yet their eyes are on their way. God even gives the wicked safety and security. They are supported by him. Isn't that the way it seems? They get away with it. Now some get caught, some get punished, but a lot get away with it. It says in verse 24, they're exalted for a little while, then they're gone. They're brought low, and they are taken out of the way. Like all others, they dry out like the heads of grain. The wicked are exalted for a short time and they die. And they die like other people and they don't get caught in the context of this chapter. So he concludes, now if it is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? He's challenging his friends to prove that he is a liar. The wicked die swiftly, sometimes slowly, sometimes swiftly, without shame, and God seems to sustain them. So all that you're accusing me of and all you're saying isn't true, it's just common sense. So let me sum up this, and I know we've gone again through a lot of verses, but let me sum it up and make a suggestion. When Eliphaz aggressively came at Job, ranting that he was a great sinner that needed to repent, all of which was a lie, by the way. Job answered that he desired to present his case before God, was confident that when he did, he would be vindicated, that God is sovereign, and the wicked are not punished with calamities as you have been claiming. All right, what do we make of this? I said last time, if I were judging a debate, I would say Job won. I mean, with common sense, right? So, I would say, he has proved they are wrong. You agree? Mm-hmm. Convinced?
Yes.
Well, he did that speeches ago. I mean, this is the seventh speech we've been through. So has he proven his case? I think so. Were they convinced? No. No. No and no. And the proof of that is we got another speech to go through yet. Bildad comes up and speaks one last time. So far, didn't take his third round. So my point is, some people are just never convinced. Now that sounds awfully simplistic. I'm almost embarrassed to say it. But you've learned that from your experience, right? So you need to answer them. You need to give a reasonable response, but you need to recognize up front, some people are never going to get it. That was a great revelation to me. If I could just keep arguing, if I could just marshal enough evidence, I could convince them, right? No. Some people are never going to get it. Never, ever. There is the story of an inmate in a mental institution who was driven by a cat that lived in his stomach and was clawing at him all the time. The doctors decided they had a remedy. They said they would remove the cat by surgery. They put him under. They made a long incision down his abdomen, and when he woke up, they showed him the black cat, and they said, "See, we got the critter that was troubling you." The patient turned pale, and he fainted. And when he came to, he said, "You got the wrong cat. The one that was bothering me was gray."
Oh, no.
Some people are never going to get it. So what do you do? Well, listen to what Job has said over and over and over again. Here's my desire. I want to give my case to the Lord. And let me point out that none of the friends have brought up the Lord at all. Have you noticed? None of them said anything about the Lord. And Job constantly goes back to the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. So, my advice is simply this. At least include the Lord and take your case to the Lord. That when you're up against people that aren't going to get it, recognize that and quit beating your head against the wall. They're not going to get it. This was a great liberating day for me when I decided, hey, Kakora, stop. They're not going to get it. What are you doing? Just relax. And if they're charging you with stuff that isn't even true and you make your case and they don't hear it, then just give up. So let me close by suggesting that's what Paul did. He started a church in Corinth and left town. And of all things, he got severely criticized by that church. He mentions it in 1 Corinthians and goes into great detail in his second letter to them that we call 2 Corinthians. But in the first letter that we call 1 Corinthians, he says this, "Moreover, it is required of a steward that one be found faithful." It's one of my favorite verses of all of Paul. "But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you." Ooh! You don't have a leg to stand on. And he says in 1 Corinthians 4:3, "It is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I know nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord. I'm not going to convince you. I'm going to quit trying. I'm going to take my case to the Lord. The passage goes on to say, and when I do that, every man will have praise from the Lord. Father, thank you for giving this common sense wisdom in your word. But teach us to live by it and not be frustrated. In Jesus' name.